Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Velocity of Content. It's Friday, April 8th, 2022. Today, as we do each week, we check in with Publishers Weekly on news from the world of books and publishing. Andrew Albanese, PW senior writer, joins me with his reporting and editorial analysis. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So this week, the London Book Fair returned to Olympia Hall, and by all accounts, the show's return was a very successful one.
Yes, and boy, I have to say, wow, do I wish I was there. I really do. And you can read my colleague Ed Nwaka's coverage on the Publishers Weekly website. He's the lone PW reporter covering this year's show, and I've been reading his coverage and, again, really wishing I'd made the trip. According to Ed's reporting, it's been a buzzy and enthusiastic return, with the first hours of the fair seeing lines forming outside the venue. And that's just not because people want to get in, but also because they had to oblige with the COVID vaccination checks, etc. And I'm told the crowd is largely mask-free as well. And the, you know, still under renovation Olympia Hall is looking good, but, you know, there's a couple of bumps in the road there. But overall, the show is looking very good. Now, one potential downside, I am hearing reports of COVID cases. So here's hoping that everyone who's in London can actually get a clean COVID test and get out of London and on the way home. Now, initial reports also suggest that while the presence of the large American publishing conglomerates is small this year, especially compared to previous years, that English publishers have crowded the floor and that there's a lot of international publishers there as well, from the UAE to Indonesia, Lithuania, Germany, and that they've all taken more prominent positions. So when the Americans come back, maybe we'll have an even bigger fair in 2023. It reports that there's a lot of business being done at this year's fair. There have been some strong panel discussions, of course, and the war in Ukraine is a very hot topic. One topic of debate among those in the publishing community, according to Ed Nwaka's reporting, is whether or not a blanket ban on all Russian publishing was appropriate. You know, it's a complicated discussion, of course, by the fact that there's just a very large and wealthy Russian population in London. And of course, there is some acknowledgement here, too, that the Russian people are victims in their own right in some respects, certainly not the way that Ukraine is now a victim of the Russian military. But with the war, we're seeing how Vladimir Putin's violent authoritarianism is suppressing the truth in his own country. And Ed reports that Ukrainian author Andrei Kirkov, who attended the fair, told PW that an outright ban on working with Russian publishers and with Russian cultural institutions is the right decision to make for right now. Kirkov said it was the publisher's responsibility to educate the world about the reality of Ukrainian history and its story. But anyway, we'll look to read a lot more about Ed's trip to London, about the London Book Fair this year. It'll be in Monday's issue of Publishers Weekly. And I'm going to cross my fingers now that I can join everyone at the next big fair for me, which would be Frankfurt. And then I'll see you all in London, hopefully in 2023.
This is National Library Week, and the American Library Association has launched its annual State of America's Libraries Report, which includes the most challenged books of the previous year. And the numbers from 2021 show a significant uptick in controversial titles.
Yeah, no surprise there, given everything that we've been talking about on this show for the last, you know, few months. Indeed, the American Library Association kicked off National Library Week with the release of its State of America's Libraries 2022 report, which, as you say, includes its annual top 10 list of most challenged books. And in the report, ALA officials note what I think many of us have already realized, and that's that schools and library staff in every state are facing an unprecedented number of attempts to ban books. In 2021, which this report measures, the ALA's Office for Intellectual Freedom was tracking 729 challenges to library, school, and university materials, resulting in about 1,600 individual book challenges or removals. And as we also know from previous conversations on this show, most of these titles are targeted at the Black or LGBTQIA plus communities. By comparison, the ALA tracked 377 challenges in 2019, by which time we'd started to see a trend with books on race and particularly books on the LGBTQIA plus community being challenged. You know, for years, it was Captain Underpants that was like the top most challenged book because, you know, some parents just can't bear the potty humor. But now the challenges are much more serious and politically driven. And you'll notice how I skipped 2020. because the number of challenges actually went down in 2020, 273, but for obvious reasons, right? Schools and libraries were closed due to the pandemic. Now, ALA officials say that the 729 challenges it tracked in 2021 is the largest number by far since it started collecting this data 20 years ago. And once again, it's telling what's on the list. Topping the list, Genderqueer by Maya Kobabi, which has appeared on nearly every list we've seen nationwide for books that are, you know, proposed being pulled out of libraries. And, you know, there's at least half a dozen other books that are targeted at the LGBTQIA community on the top 10 list. I won't list them all here. You can check out the report or see the report on the PW site as well. Now, again, let's not kid ourselves about what's going on here, right? We've said it before and we'll say it again. This is an organized national political strategy on the right being executed on a local level, basically to drum up, you know, voters and, you know, get the base riled up ahead of the midterms this year. And it's designed to intimidate some voters too, but mostly it's, you know, a way to animate voters on the right. And, you know, I personally find it a pretty craven political strategy. It really sort of cuts to the heart of our democracy when we talk about banning books. But I should point out, too, that it really is a vocal minority. And when we've seen people stand up to this opposition in their communities, these book bans are very often stopped or reversed. But again, the book bans are not so much the point. This really is a strategy to energize voters on the right. As John Kraska from the group Every Library points out, it is about the, quote, weaponization of parental control as an issue in the election. Now, in Monday's issue, I have a preview of the Texas Library Association meeting, which is coming up at the end of this month. And in that, there's a lot of discussion about book bans there, which has been a hot topic in Texas. And TLA President Daniel Burgard, at one point in my story, noted that, you know, the idea that using librarians and teachers as ammunition in political campaigns and, quoting him, to willfully, purposefully seek to destroy the faith and trust that people hold in public education and in libraries, it's just shocking. And his successor, Mary Woodard, a school librarian, added that she never thought she'd see this kind of thing happen in the United States. But in 2022, here we are.
On Capitol Hill Thursday, Maryland Representative Jamie Raskin, chairman of the Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, along with ranking member Nancy Mace, a South Carolina Republican, heard testimony about the impact of book challenges on readers, especially young ones.
Yeah, so I think it's very good news that the issue is finally getting this kind of exposure in Congress, although I think it's also quite alarming that it's actually come to this. You know, the hearing notes that, you know, these efforts to ban books are part of a broader attack on free speech in the classroom that amounts to educational censorship. So given the severity, the seriousness of that, I'm glad to see Congress taking an interest in it. You can read more about the hearing on the PW site, and there's a YouTube link to the hearing. You can go back and watch it. Thought it was a very good hearing, a very stirring opening by Chairman Raskin, who's a constitutional scholar, just a very thoughtful guy. And, you know, the first panel of students who appeared and gave testimony, I thought were excellent as well. You know, one of the students noted that, you know, the issues that are in these books that are being banned are issues that students face every day in their lives. And these students need to know they're not alone when they're facing these issues, right? You know, a parent of a transgender student who also testified noted that no book could have made her child choose to be transgender any more than it could have changed her eyes from brown to blue. But books have certainly helped her child feel accepted. Another student said students from the LGBTQIA community need to see themselves on the shelves. And she noted that, you know, the only time that these students have a chance to hear about their experiences is when their basic human rights are being debated. I thought that was a very cogent thing to bring up as well, that you just need to see these experiences in a more regular setting every day. These students need to see themselves on the shelves of their library. Now, there was minority witnesses as well. For example, the minority witness stressed that there is a problem with conservatives being shouted down on college campus, right? But he mostly shrugged off the banning of books in our schools as, you know, sort of the rights of parents in their communities to make these decisions. And he pointed to Maya Kobabi's book, which is number one on the ALA list. It's called Genderqueer, as being so obscene that some parents couldn't even read it aloud at a school board meeting. Why they're reading it aloud at a school board meeting is another question, because there are processes in place for parents to challenge this book. The only reason you would read it at a school board meeting is if you're trying to get a headline. But that's another thing. Don't get me started there. So, you know, he basically argued that it's not censorship when a book is this obscene. It's a responsibility for parents and school boards to remove these books. But that was sort of rebutted later by a teacher who singled out what she called the fallacy of the parental rights argument here, which is, you know, just because, you know, you may think a book is too racy or too, you know, not educational in its value, it doesn't give you the right to ban it for other students in the country who may see that book as a lifeline. And then in the Q&A period, there were some legislators who suggested that, you know, school boards as taxing authorities, that, you know, they really do have the decisions about what goes on the shelves in their hands, which, of course, in some respects is true. However, again, there are processes in place that govern this, right? You should follow those processes. It shouldn't just be a political issue argued out in the comment section, public comment section of a school board meeting. But again, that's not really what's at issue here. And all the panelists pointed this out. Yes, parents have a say. Of course, parents have a say, and they should have a say in what goes on in their schools. And of course, they have a say in the supervision of their own children. If they don't like a certain book in the library, well, don't let your child read it, right? There's that. But what we're talking about here is the systematic denial by government of certain views or histories or lifestyles. And this is where those supporting book bans kind of fell flat. They talked about Ann Coulter getting shouted down at UC Berkeley, and the conservatives are being shouted down on college campuses. Like that was the real issue here. Now, look, I might agree with the idea that, as Raskin pointed out in his opening remarks, we all need to learn to tolerate better the speech we don't agree with. At the same time, let's be clear. One group of private citizens shouting down another speaker is not censorship. That's also free speech, right? As illiberal as it may be, that is also free speech. On the other hand, a government agency like a school board outlawing subjects from being mentioned in school, like Florida's Don't Say Gay Bill, or a local school board banning the teaching of the 1619 Project, which also happened in Florida, that by definition is censorship. And look, just because you have a free speech right doesn't protect you from the free speech rights of others to necessarily shout you down. But when government shuts you down or shouts you down, well, I think we can agree that's just wrong. So it was a very interesting hearing. Again, my point, I think, stands the point I've held all along here, which is that most Americans are really quite against pulling books from library shelves. Most Americans really do want to stand up against censorship. But this is a political fight, right? As the author Ruby Bridges told the committee, books share our history. That history shouldn't be changed or banned just because some parents don't agree with it or like it.
And the Campaign for Freedom to Read also now has supporters on Wall Street.
So something very cool here. NASDAQ has invited the American Library Association and supporters of Freedom to Read to ring the closing bell at today's trading session. So make what you will of that. It seems like Wall Street is certainly in support of Freedom to Read. And if you get a chance later to tune in for the closing bell at NASDAQ, you can see the library community in support of Freedom to Read ringing the closing bell. So just another thing during National Library Week to support our libraries and call attention to this issue.
All right. And that rings the closing bell on our podcast this week. Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for joining me on the program.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on the next podcast from CCC, the ambitious goal of the recently launched GW Journal of Ethics in Publishing is to be a platform for discussion of realities of publishing, including diversity and inclusion, accessibility, sustainability, and equity. According to John Warren, the journal's originator and a GWU associate professor, ethics in publishing has long been a capstone course in GW's Master of Professional Studies program in publishing. And in 2020, Warren decided the subject also deserved its own scholarly journal. Publishing is notorious for moving slowly, for being resistant to change, and even being in some ways indifferent to ethical concerns. Is this new generation, the students you have in your program, are they going to change that?
I do think that they're the future leaders of today and tomorrow, that's for sure. And I think they will change publishing. I think you're already seeing that.
Ethics in Publishing gets its own journal, coming on the next CCC podcast. Our producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. You can subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts, and please do follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening, to this Velocity of Content podcast from CCC.